All right. Good afternoon. Excuse me, sorry. Welcome to day two. We're trying to get through it without getting the... seems like all of us are getting some sort of scratchy throat. I don't know if anyone saw Scott's session just before that, but he's in worse shape than he appears, actually. He did a good job, I think, for being looking pretty out of it this morning. I missed the middle of it, but it's when I saw him this morning. I didn't think he would make the session. Anyway, welcome to OUC 310. We're here to talk this afternoon about Exchange migrations to Office 365. So in this session, what we're going to do is cover your migration choices. You have quite a few options for bringing an organization or a subsidiary or subset of your users over to Office 365. We'll spend the first 15 to 20 minutes walking pretty quickly through the IMAP cutover and staged migration approaches, just so you have awareness of those. As a question, has anyone here actually used an IMAP staged or cutover migration to move users to Office 365? All right, it's I don't see any hands go up. So we'll spend a little bit of time on that. Those are our sort of, we can call them legacy. If you've got either an older version of Exchange or a competing mail platform, for example, these are some excellent choices to bring you to Office 365, and some good detail on the pros and cons of each one of those choices. So you show you what works, what doesn't work, what the end user experience will be like, and you'll have those slides for reference. There are around, I think it's around 62 or 63 slides in this deck, including some of the agendas and overview slides, right? So we're going to go through pretty quickly. A lot of times I'm just going to cover sort of the highlight or reference, but we wanted you to have the content there, sort of a single point you can go to look through. Say, I remember Andrew talked about staged migrations, but I don't remember exactly some of the caveats there, right? Feel free to download the deck and pull that out, see exactly what it is. Second half of the presentation will focus on the hybrid migration strategy, which we introduced with Exchange 2010, and we've expanded and extrapolated upon with Exchange 2013. We have quite a rich coexistence strategy with the hybrid approach, as well as some very impressive user options for cutting people over and or deploying an organization that has both an on-prem and an online component for Office 365. So with that, let's take a quick look. This slide is excellent because it shows you, of those four options, IMAP, cutover, staged, and hybrid, which work with which platforms. So as we can see, if you're looking at some Exchange 2003 or prior, or even Exchange 5.5, Exchange 2000, or Notes, Domino, GroupWise, we see some Sun, iPlanet, for example, or other IMAP-type solutions. We have the IMAP migration approach. We'll walk you through what that requires from a permissions level, what it looks like from a user perspective, some caveats on what can or can't come over. Once you get into the Exchange space, if you've got Exchange 2003, we can run with the cutover, staged, or the 2010 hybrid approach. And same is true for 2007. Once we get into the 2010 and 2013, we have the options for hybrid. If you do have Exchange 2003 or Exchange 2007, we can add an Exchange 2010 set of servers to the org to configure hybrid. We like the hybrid approach because it gives you, in our opinion, the most flexibility as you decide to move over or cut over to Office 365. The end user experience is preserved from on-prem to the online environments. I'll show you what those feature sets are and some other aspects around that. But we understand not everyone's going to have the ability to add a new version of Exchange or to have an Exchange environment altogether to make that migration happen. And so that's why we'll walk you through some of those different choices as we go through. So additionally, there's the non-sort of administrator-driven ones, right? So we can always take in a very small org or a simple environment, just do a user-driven migration. The simplest is you provision new mailboxes in Office 365, users begin using it. With mail being around for over 20 years, it's very rare that we see this sort of greenfield approach. Obviously it exists, but typically users have some data in a source platform that they'd like to bring over. That could be a PST file. They bring it, you provision an empty mailbox, they attach their PST to Outlook, either they import it themselves or they continue to leverage that PST. Or you can use this option that we call connected accounts. Connected accounts will pull the mail from their source platform into Office 365. They'll move their contacts and calendar and other aspects around that. We've got that underline or hyperlink there actually brings you to the article on TechNet that walks through the connected account process. Connected accounts doesn't require administrative level access to the source mail platform. So that's why we classify those under the end user driven approaches. If you do have administrative access to the source mail platform, you can go through a new mailbox plus the PST import tool. We acquired a company a couple of years ago that provides the capability of having a mapping of source PST files and names, and then have that tool run through and import those mailboxes or import those PSTs into the mailbox on Office 365. The PST import tool, of course, requires you to have some admin level permissions there, as you'd probably be doing some exports of the source environment and then leveraging the PST import process going forward. This kind of shows, right, there's lots of different scenarios that we're looking at when we talk about which method you use. There's going to be choices as to how you do your directory of replication to Office 365. You'll have the identity and authorization discussions as well. So if you went to the Office 365 sessions yesterday and this morning, you learned that there's multiple ways you can use to get your on-prem user information, right, that set of attributes such as names and phone numbers and email addresses replicated to Office 365. We have the DirSync appliance, you can use FIM, you can do cutovers with CSV files and whatnot. Once you have this directory information there, you'll have the second choice of what your authorization mechanism is. So I think it was Paul's session, we talked about the concept of identity and authorization. You'll have to decide, do you want Office 365 to authenticate the users? Do you want it to authenticate the users but have your password hashes be replicated to Office 365? Or do you want Office 365 to redirect that authentication to your local on-prem AD? And all of those come with some trade-offs, right, some pros and cons, and they also have some impact as to which one of these migration approaches you can leverage. We'll talk a little more about that as we get into the differences between things like a cutover and a stage migration, for example. So as you go through this concept of looking at what my source platform is, what level of permissions I have, and then finally, what level of process for identity and authorization am I using in Office 365, it unblocks the different scenarios we have around moving mailboxes and bringing that mailbox data content. Summary point is, we like to say Office 365 is a very simple, straightforward approach, right? It can be, but if you want a rich user experience, meaning that as you move those mailboxes, they continue to have free busy, they continue to have their calendars work, things like mail tips will work back and forth, that's a little bit more planning on your part, right, and some infrastructure required to set that up and bring that process to fruition. So with that, let's take a look through at these migration approaches. First one to walk through is IMAP. Very straightforward, right? You can have just about any source mail platform that supports IMAP. We support for an IMAP migration into Office 365. Doesn't matter if that source platform is one that you have on-prem, or if you're getting that from a hosted or a third party, we do not require any administrative level functionality there, just the credentials back to those users and the mailbox content. We can do batch migrations, and because we don't require an on-prem migration tool, right, we can do that from a hoster or a third party without any other access to that. We do require some technical prerequisites, so obviously there's some permissions, some TCP ports and network access that we require, and either credentials for each individual user mailbox or an administrative level account that has permissions across all the mailboxes themselves. Once you have that, you prepare some CSV file or files, you put the data into that as required, and we will bring that data from that source IMAP platform over to Office 365 for you. What's migrated? Their mail content, right? We get the mailbox, we get the other folders. We don't migrate more than 500,000 items in a source mailbox if you've got some very large source ones. It is possible to exclude some of the default folders such as deleted items or junk email from the migration scope if you want to reduce some of the bandwidth required to bring the mail content over. What's not migrated, right? Things that aren't visible there in the IMAP platform. Contacts, calendar, tasks, etc. are not part of the IMAP spec, and so we can't see that on the source mailbox. Any folders that have a forward slash in there, any messages more than 25 megs, won't come through via IMAP. All right, so we have some richer options. The next option above IMAP would be something that we call a cutover exchange migration. When we say cutover, that means that day one, we have some subset of users on the source platform. Day two, those users are running on Office 365. So let's kind of walk through what this cutover approach looks like or how it works. It's richer than IMAP. We're going to use Outlook Anywhere to reach back to the source system, which means that we can see their mailbox as well as calendar and contacts and tasks and all other sort of data that they have in their source mailbox environment, and we'll bring all of that content over to Office 365. Users are automatically provisioned, so one of the steps with Office 365 is to license and provision your users in the cutover Exchange migration. We automatically take care of that provisioning part as we bring the data across. From an Exchange perspective, we introduced Outlook Anywhere with Exchange 2003, so 2003, 2007, 2010, 2013, all will work with a cutover Exchange migration. From a cutover Exchange migration identity perspective, our assumption is that at first, you will use Office 365 or cloud identities. You won't have ADFS, for example, or other ones set up. You could go back and modify that choice later, but during the migration portion, they're leveraging a user object and password that's managed out in Office 365. No on-prem migration tool. Rationale behind that is we're reaching back with Outlook Anywhere, so we don't need something on-prem to be able to read from those source servers. The as I mentioned, right, we use Outlook Anywhere to do the pull. We also would like a migration account that has either full access or the receive as permissions in the source environment. That ensures that we have a single account that can read all the mailboxes we're going to try to pull in via Outlook Anywhere. Prior to going through cutover, we want to set up the SMTP domains for mail and for routing in Office 365. We want to go through the process to validate that we own those domains. We publish the TXT record to show that we're authoritative. That ensures that as we bring the users over in the cutover migration, they can start receiving mail in that mailbox, and we don't have that that step performed prior. So post-cutover, right, we'll switch that MX record. Now all of our users will be live and active with new mail flow to Office 365. DIR sync is disabled at the beginning. In the cutover process, we're specifying the user accounts manually there. We would potentially have the option to go back and change that after the fact, but for cutover, we're leveraging from a identity perspective, cloud accounts, and from a DIR sync, from a directory perspective, a one-time importation of the users to Office 365. We also have a limit on the number of source mailboxes. So if you have more than 1,000 users in your source platform, we recommend going to a staged migration approach or to a hybrid migration approach to move the users. Primary behind that is that at a certain point, the number of people we can cut over in a short time frame, right, let's say a weekend or an extended holiday weekend, will be is limited by how fast we can import data to Office 365. And so cutover is everybody at once. With stage and with hybrid, we can gradually bring the users. And so if we do a single cutover, we want to have enough time to make sure the people come over so that there's enough time to bring all that content over so they're accessing full mailbox content once they get to the other side. We mentioned that we're not using the concept of DIR sync for the directory approach. What we actually use is the Outlook NSPI provider, or the name services provider interface. This essentially allows us to bring over the directory information that the Outlook client sees. So every user, individual user, has an Outlook client using Outlook Anywhere. That Outlook client has two synchronization mechanisms. One brings down the user directory and creates the offline address list. One brings the mailbox content. We use NSPI to bring over that directory information. We recreate that directory information in the Office 365 tenant, and now we have a live, up-to-date vision of that directory just as if the user was connected to their source platform. At the same time, the cutover migration can pull the mailbox data via Outlook Anywhere, and thus the contents come over for each of the mailboxes that we specify in the cutover Exchange migration. The provisioning aspect, we mentioned that in cutover, we will create and provision those cloud IDs automatically. Passwords are created for each one of those cloud IDs. We will then notify the admin of all those new passwords. Your responsibility then is to notify the users of their new Office 365 password. So from a planning perspective, you point your cutover migration wizard towards your on-prem environment. We'll replicate the users via NSPI. We will create cloud accounts for them, create passwords for them, and then start pulling the data over via Outlook Anywhere. Once that cutover process is complete, you will switch the MX record. Users can then start leveraging or consuming Office 365. They'll have a full directory of information, and they'll have all their mailbox content that's visible from an Outlook client perspective. So if we look at that, that doesn't include things such as the dumpster recoverable items. Those are server-level attributes that are not visible from the Outlook client, or things such as litigation or in-place hold type policies. Send as permission, security group, system mailboxes, those are left behind on the source platform. Also, same concept, right, true throughout, messages more than 25 megs. We have a 25 meg maximum size item restriction in Office 365, so that restriction carries through across all of our migration approaches. Different from IMAP is you notice that we have a lot more data coming over. Essentially, it's what's visible in the Outlook client from their perspective, calendar, contacts, journal, right, mail items, mail folders, et cetera, will all flow over as we have access to that information via either NSPI or via Outlook Anywhere. With the cutover approach, there's no concept of partial migrations. I can't take an org of 700 and do two different 350 user migrations. I'm doing all at once. I also couldn't take a 2,000 user org and make 2,000 or two 1,000 cutover migrations. If I want to do staging, I'm using the next approach we'll talk about called a stage exchange migration, which you'll recognize many of the aspects of being similar. The hidden mailboxes, as we said, won't come over because those aren't visible to NSPI or the Outlook Anywhere clients. And because the mailbox that's created is a new mailbox provisioned in Office 365, this means that the new mailbox has a new GUID, which means we have an OST resync. So in a cutover migration, day after the migration, when the user connects their Outlook client, they will be resynchronizing their offline storage file. So if we have a large amount of data in that source platform, we will have a time period where people will be re-downloading or recaching that data post the migration event. We'll talk more about this GUID concept and the improvements around that on hybrid, which is kind of the justification for our recommendation around the hybrid side. End user experience, as we stated, new cloud accounts are created or provisioned, means that you as the administrator will be responsible for taking those cloud accounts and passwords, disseminating them to the user population, and ensuring users are aware of how to go through and update their password process. The users will have their Outlook profiles automatically created. At the end of their cutover event, we will change the DNS records to point to Office 365. At that point, their Outlook 2007 and later clients will leverage AutoDiscover, will generate the profile, and synchronize and create a new OST for that mail content copied in the cutover. High-level summary. First portion, ensure Outlook Anywhere is published to the internet. Office 365 uses Outlook Anywhere both to read that directory information as well as to read the mailbox information. We validate that with the remote connectivity analyzer or the Exchange RCA and ensure that we have an account with permissions. We can then launch the wizard, say that we want to do a cutover exchange migration approach. At that point, the wizard or Office 365 cutover migration tool will reach back via NSPI, read the directory information for that organization, and provision and create those mailboxes and directory information in Office 365. We then start the synchronization process, run through the Delta Sync, right, and continually update the Office 365 environment to keep it replicated with your on-prem environment. Once you're at a close period of synchronization, you cut over the MX record, tell the wizard the migration is complete. We will do a final synchronize of user mailbox content for anything that has not synced since the MX record previously pointed on-prem, and then go through, license our users, and have them start consuming their mailbox from Office 365. At this point, there is no coexistence, either from a directory perspective or from a mail flow perspective. So users are either 100% on-prem, post-migration, they're 100% cloud. Question in the back middle. Question is, are the messages flagged that they've been migrated? There's no concept of that because it's either, it's a synchronizing process. So if a user marks a message as read on-prem, we will mark that message read as it goes to online. Is that kind of where you're going? So question would be like, what about missing items or messages, for example, that exceed the size limit, or messages that are corrupt, for example, that we couldn't read? How are those reported? I'm looking around, I see a couple of the other folks in here. I'm not sure. I'm looking at a couple of the guys in the back. No one's raising their hand and say they know it authoritatively. I'll look that one up for you. So since you stumped me, I think you get a webcam. I'll pass it out after taking a jump. Yeah, I knew there's a log. So the, Jeff is commenting in the back. There is a log post the cutover migration event. I haven't parsed through that in a while, and I can't remember to confirm that there's things like over the size limit or other items. So we'll double check on that one. All right, let's see how my clicker doesn't work. Next approach is called a staged exchange migration. So if you're familiar with cutover, we do the directory replication via NSPI, half of Outlook Anywhere. Mailbox content comes over via the Outlook Anywhere process to sync the mailbox content. The benefits to staged is now we can set up a coexistence infrastructure and move users in batches. So rather than doing a NSPI call to replicate the directory data from on-prem to Office 365, we do the replication using the Office 365 DirSync appliance. The DirSync appliance will read the on-prem Active Directory information, replicate that to the Office 365 tenant, and keep that Office 365 tenant up to date. As you make changes on-prem, it's pushed up to Office 365. The approach for stage then allows us, as we said, to have batches of users moved. We will take care of the addressing and the mail flow during this approach. So as you move a user to Office 365, they continue to show up in the directory for all users, either on-prem or online. They'll have their mailbox content online using the same Outlook Anywhere data pull approach. But at the same time, you are not restricted in moving all of your users at once. So with this approach, going back to, obviously, Exchange 2003, you can now have a directory sync as your directory replication method and a data migration approach to bring over your user visible data content and do that in migration batches. Identity management, as we call out, still stays on your on-prem Active Directory. We will read from that and write that to the Office 365 tenant. Same concept as prior. We don't require an on-prem migration tool because we'll read the data from the Outlook Anywhere endpoint. So as long as you've got Outlook Anywhere published in your organization, we're able to read and consume that and pull that mailbox content over. You probably recognize this slide. Same permissions required as we have for a cutover. We need something that has full mailbox rights to receive permissions to those mailboxes. Additionally, in this case, we're going to require the directory sync tool to be provisioned. And, sorry, it wasn't working. Now it's definitely not working. Or maybe I fixed it. Let's see. The DirSync tool, right, will be leveraged to replicate Active Directory to the Office 365 tenant. This means that in the tenant itself, we have to configure DirSync to be enabled. So with that, we then can take a look. We don't support staged exchange migrations for Exchange 2010 and Exchange 2013. The rationale behind this is with these versions, we support hybrid exchange migrations, which give us more flexibility and a richer level of coexistence between our on-prem environment and the Office 365 side. With staged exchange migrations, it is true we can move the users in batches, but we do not have access to things such as free busy. If a user has an out of office or a mail tip right for someone outside the organization, that's going to show up for a person who's on-prem sending to Office 365, because in a staged migration, those are essentially two different entities. So there's no way for us to span or ensure that both organizations appear as internal for all of the users inside. So staged gives you the ability to move mailboxes in batches, but it does not give you the rich coexistence that a hybrid migration will give you, which is what the next section will cover. So if you remember, in cutover, we leveraged NSPI to do the directory replication. In staged, we leveraged DirSync to do the directory replication. With cutover, we leveraged Outlook Anywhere to do the data pull. With staged, we leveraged Outlook Anywhere to do the data pull. Pre-coexistence, we've got some users who are enabled on-prem. We've got our MX record configured to point to the on-prem environment. In this case, we have a user, John Doe at contoso.com. Mail is sent. Mail flows inbound. We know how that process works. When we go to add staged exchange migration, we will provision our Office 365 tenant. When we provision our Office 365 tenant, we will have a name, typically our domain name, .onmicrosoft.com. So that namespace is associated with the Office 365 tenant. We will create an MX record pointing to that namespace. Therefore, mail that flows to John Doe or Andrew, for example, at contoso.mail on Microsoft.com flows to the Office 365 tenant. Once we go through and configure the concept of a cutover migration and we have directory replication established, we will replicate all of the on-prem users and their directory information to Office 365. When we put them in Office 365, we add an additional target address on those user objects, which is the, a SMTP address, right, of John Doe at contoso.mail at microsoft.com. We now have a separate SMTP subdomain on the Office 365 side that we can use to route mail from on-prem off to Office 365. When we mark a user to be moved, we change their target address for their on-prem mailbox to the SMTP address of their Office 365 mailbox, one of their secondary SMTP addresses. At that point, mail that flows on-prem to John Doe at contoso.com will be forwarded to the target address because the target address attribute is set. The target address attribute points to a completely new SMTP domain. It's a standard MX lookup, standard mail flow to get to Office 365. So mail flowing in, hits John Doe. We realize John Doe has a target address set. We forward the mail to Office 365. In reverse, we can set the target address for any user who's replicated to Office 365 but has not yet been migrated to have the target address of @contoso.com. With the staged exchange migration, we use the standard exchange routing, which says, I'm contoso.com, but I have the option to say, if I have a message for a recipient who's not in my organization but @contoso.com, forward to this next hop. That next hop would be our on-prem mail environment, which means that mail flowing to a user who's been provisioned in Office 365 but does not yet have a mailbox will flow from Office 365 back to on-prem. So here we can see mail flowing, finds the proxy address, sees the target address is set, we'll send it to Office 365. In this case, same concept, target address is set, target address is local, we'll receive the mail. For flowing the other way around, right, in this case, Jane Doe has been replicated to Office 365, but her mailbox has not yet been migrated. She has an SMTP primary reply address of Jane Doe at contoso.com, a target address, which matches her primary, which matches the on-prem environment. So mail that flows to her, we notice that the target address attribute is set. We then route the mail to that target address attribute, which points to Jane Doe at contoso.com. We realize that she is not local to Office 365, so we will forward that message via an MX call to the on-prem environment. And so we have coexistence from a mail flow perspective. Users retain their traditional reply to address. However, they can mail back and forth regardless of which side they're on during that staged exchange migration process. So summary, accounts are provisioned via DirSync. This means that for every user that we have on-prem, we'll have either a mail-enabled user or a mailbox for them in Office 365. If it's a mailbox, we'll use Outlook Anywhere to pull the data over. If it's a mail-enabled user, we understand that that's just a user who has not yet been migrated, and we route the mail, as we pointed in the last couple slides, back to their on-prem environment. Yes, question. So the question is, in a staged migration, is there an OST resync required? The answer to that is yes, because we still have a new mailbox being provisioned in Office 365. Another way to think about this is this will answer a lot more of your questions, which will be, when do I get a new OST? The only time we preserve the OST is when the mailbox, when Outlook goes to synchronize, it checks the mailbox GUID. If the mailbox GUID is the same, it does not need to do a resynchronize, it will just do delta updates against the mailbox. When I do a mailbox move in exchange all the way back, right, we preserve the mailbox GUID. In a hybrid migration approach from 2010 or 2013, or a cross-forest migration that uses the mailbox replication service, or MRS, we preserve the GUID. And so anytime that GUID is preserved, you do not have an OST resync after the fact. Anytime you see documentation where a new mailbox is provisioned, means new GUID, means new synchronized to the OST portion. With dirsync, the first time you have that, you will actually specify passwords for your users. So in the cutover approach, we provision and create the passwords. In staged, we use dirsync to provision, and the dirsync tool asks you for the passwords, right? So you'll provide a list of passwords you'll have for users, and at that point, then the administrators can force users to change or enable the option to force your users to change your passwords. You're responsible again, right, for disseminating the password information to the end user community. The staged Exchange Migration Wizard on Office 365 will have the option to upload a CSV. That's the email address, right? So which user on the source platform, what their new password should be, and the option of whether or not you want to force passwords. For a staged Exchange Migration, we have a maximum per event of 1,000 users. You'll run the event. Once that's complete, you'll be able to stage the next 1,000 coming across. Looking at what's migrated, very similar to cutover because we're using the same data extraction method as a cutover. Office 365 Staged Exchange Migration Wizard will reach back using Outlook Anywhere to your on-prem Outlook Anywhere endpoint, bring over mail, rules, calendar, contacts, tasks, delegates, etc. to their Office 365 mailbox. It's not migrated, security groups, dynamic distribution lists, system mailboxes, dumpster, right, litigation hold concepts, or content, same concept as we had in cutover because those items are not visible from an Outlook Anywhere perspective. The one of the things that's not possible in a staged exchange migration is trying to limit. It's sometimes common in a mail migration to say, I want to bring over the last 30 days or the last 120 days of mail. I'll leave the rest in the source platform. And I start with, therefore, an empty mailbox or a lighter mailbox, or I reduce my migration content. Therefore, I can increase my migration velocity. In this case, cutover and exchange don't have a method of filtering how much data should we bring across. Our assumption is you'll bring all of it. We have, previous to a week or two ago, we had a 25 gig mailbox for users in Office 365. As of a couple weeks ago, that's been doubled to 50 gigs. And if you've got the option that allows you the archive mailbox, you have an unlimited archive store. And so therefore, we have a substantial amount of data storage. We'll bring the data across as is to the other side. Question had come up, right? We're showing that because, again, a new GUID is created when we provision the mailbox using the stage exchange migration wizard, user will have an OST resync when we use them. Passwords have to be distributed. Everything is going to be downloaded once the user synchronizes. Outlook client, again, 2007 or later, will leverage AutoDiscover to rebuild that mail profile. Approach looks very similar to the cutover, with the exception that the middle four bars, you will repeat for each block of users that you migrate. Stage exchange migration summary. Directory information comes across with dirsync. Very straightforward to configure and set up. As you upload a CSV file with your list of users to cut over, their password, and whether you want them to change it, those users will be migrated or their data will be copied to Office 365. We will preserve mail flow between both sets of users, all that have been migrated and all who remain on the source platform. At the end of the migration, you can go ahead and change the MX record, have Office 365 or Exchange Online Protection be the endpoint of that, and leverage Office 365 primarily for your mail platform. Any questions on IMAP, cutover, or staged? All right, couple. Question is, on a cutover migration, if you're coming from Exchange 2010, can you pull archive? Cutover and staged are for 2007 and prior. We would say hybrid approach for 2010 or later. So, and hybrid, we would bring over the archive mailbox. Alias email addresses? Yes, so question is, when you're uploading the CSV to the staged exchange migration wizard, what do you have to provide for the email address? Just the reply address. Is that where you're going, or? Yep. Yes, the question is, could you have other alias addresses in there? It's not required because DirSync is already populating the other alias addresses to Office 365. So the purpose of that email address is purely an identifier of the mailbox that you need to migrate. So the question was, right, like if you look at that cutover CSV file, it only has a single email address per user. It's not migrating the email address at that time. You've already established DirSync, and DirSync has replicated your AD environment and the user properties to Office 365. That would include their primary reply plus any subsequent proxy addresses. So the only thing that's happening in that spreadsheet is you have to call out in each migration event which specific users do you want to migrate, and we use their default reply to address as the unique identifier. So you specify that. We move that mailbox content over to the Office 365 side, but we've already got a user out there that has Office, phone number, primary, proxy addresses, other aspects around that. Any others? One more. Yes, there is a note for staged and cutover. We do not support UM-enabled mailboxes because moving a UM-enabled mailbox would break the voicemail for that user. We do have the process on that for hybrid migrations, but we don't have it for staged and cutover because we want, if you put a UM-enabled mailbox in your cutover or exchange migration, staged exchange migration CSV file, we will fail on that mailbox because when we moved to Office 365, there is no way in our move process to tell the on-prem PBX environment to route the calls to Office 365 UM. So those are handled individually by the administrator. You would disable it for UM, cut it over, and then point the mailbox functionality to Exchange Online UM. All right, let's talk. And if there's more questions, feel free to come up after. I don't want to miss the hybrid portion, which is the one we want to spend most of our time explaining and walking you through. A hybrid relationship between an on-prem Exchange org and Office 365 is relatively straightforward to configure. It essentially involves assigning the on-prem organization a federation trust. This is not an Active Directory trust. This is essentially a certificate exchange that ensures that the Office 365 tenant trusts the on-prem environment, and reciprocity occurs that the on-prem Exchange 2010 or 2013 environment understands and trusts the Office 365 tenant that you're establishing it with. Once we have this federation trust established, we have what is called in our documentation rich coexistence. And rich coexistence, what we mean is that when a user is on-prem or when a user is in Office 365, it is invisible to the other users in the organization. FreeBSY continues to work. You have a full directory of user information. Changes to your on-prem user directory will be reflected in Office 365 automatically. So you're managing your identity locally. We're replicating that information to Office 365. Things such as calendar sharing, message tracking, right? Some of the more advanced features in Exchange will continue to work, again, regardless whether that mailbox is on-prem or that mailbox is online. Administratively, we now manage both your Exchange on-prem environment and the Office 365 environment from the same interface. So you don't have two separate platforms. You've got a common management interface. You have a common directory of users. When you go to move the mailboxes, it's like moving it to yet another server in your org, right? You're pointing to an Office 365 endpoint, but from an Exchange perspective, that's a native MRS or mailbox replication service move. This means we preserve the GUID, meaning there's no OSD resync required. This means that it's an online move. User can continue to access their mailbox while we're moving the mail content. Once the mail content's been moved, depending on their version of Outlook and the stars alignment, right, they may or may not get that little dialog box that says Outlook has created a change. It requires you to restart your client. If they do not get the box, they continue to work all as well. Sometimes they get the box, they have to close Outlook, restart it, and they're operating against their online mailbox post the restart. The mail flow between on-prem and Office 365 is encrypted via TLS. So from a data transport perspective, we say that all mail flow, client to server and server to server on-prem is encrypted. Once you configure hybrid, that encryption continues to apply even when those recipients are in your Office 365 tenant. So from a coexistence perspective, hybrid offers the ultimate choice. It's above that from IMAP, cutover, and staged. This really provides you the option of having that Office 365 tenant, moving people back and forth, but preserving all their information and preserving the normal management and security processes that you've already defined with your on-prem environment. So looking at this right, in a simple or the staged or cutover migrations, what we have is mail routing and a unified GAL. Once we go to hybrid, we add all of the other functionality along with that. So this enables you as an Exchange administrator to rapidly move your users or slowly move your users. It becomes your choice, right? The free busy, as we called out, once we have the hybrid configured, we have the same concept as if you've done a org-to-org federated relationship. We trust the free busy queries from each endpoint, and those free busy queries are interpreted as a local user, meaning that a user in Exchange Online can add a user in their Outlook dialog box for a meeting request. Richard and Sally, in this case, we have one user on one user on the other. Once we go to rich coexistence, Richard's able to see Sally's free busy, right? So in this case, from an end user perspective, they're not aware of which users are on-prem and which users are online. As long as you're using Outlook 2007 or later, or Outlook web app, we will show their free busy information. We also will understand that both Richard and Sally are internal to the organization, even though they span two different Exchange environments. This means that when Richard sends Sally a message, it's not going to prompt and say that Sally is remote, right, or outside of your organization. Once we configure hybrid, Sally, even though she's in a different org, appears inside because we understand that both of those are actually part of the same Exchange hybrid relationship organization. The other aspect is on cross-prem mail flow, there's typically not a trusted connector. And so from an internal perspective, when you see a recipient in your Outlook client and you double-click on that user, we launch the Active Directory dialog box, right, or the Outlook dialog box that shows the Active Directory properties. So you're able to see it's a resolution to the actual person who sent it internally, and we can read a rich amount of information from that person. When we receive a message from the internet or from an untrusted Exchange organization, we just get the raw SMTP address when we open that dialog box. Once we set up hybrid, voila, now all of a sudden the messages are trusted. We leverage TLS between the Exchange Online organization and the on-prem organization, and therefore we'll bring up the Active Directory user object for that person. This doesn't matter if Richard's on-prem and Sally's online or vice versa. Both orgs trust the information flow between each other. With a staged Exchange migration or a cutover migration, there's also the discussion of URL planning. Cutover is probably straightforward. You move the URLs to Exchange Online at the same time you move the mailbox data. But staged brings some planning. With staged, you're moving users in batches, which means that you have a source OAuth URL, a source Outlook Anywhere, a source ActiveSync URL, and you've got a target OAuth, a target ActiveSync, a target Outlook Anywhere URL. So there's some communication required for users explaining you're either on the source system or you're on the Office 365 platform. With hybrid, we're able to provide you with a single OAuth URL. Users can continue to leverage the Outlook web app URL that they have. We don't have this issue of trying to determine whether a user is online or on-prem and then manage the communications going out to end users related to that aspect. From our perspective, hybrid is the preferred approach. It makes a single, seamless Exchange organization. It's relatively straightforward to configure, as we'll walk through and show you in a couple of minutes, and gives you, from as you saw in the last couple of slides, a very user-invisible or seamless process, right, for end users to go through their typical mail workflow without understanding that there's some mail transition activities occurring on the back end. From a requirements perspective, we do require, question. question is public folder access. With Exchange Hybrid, we will so we have a couple choices here as to whether or not which tenant we're on in Office 365. If we're on Wave 14 tenant, the ones that are being upgraded to Wave 15, which is nearly complete or should maybe completed by now. The completion was around the late August or September timeframe. The users in Exchange Online, when you're configured in a hybrid relationship, will be redirected to the on-prem public folder environment. With a Wave 15 tenant, you can be redirected or you can migrate your public folder content to Exchange Online. We do support what are called modern public folders in a Wave 15 tenant. So if you have a public folder hierarchy or infrastructure today, you have two choices. You can either have users be redirected, you can keep the infrastructure and hierarchy on-prem, and with a hybrid relationship, users will be redirected to the on-prem environment, either 14 or 15 tenants. If you have a Wave 15 tenant, you have the option of actually importing or migrating your public folder content from on-prem to the new modern public folders backend in Office 365. From a requirement perspective, we require from a 2013 one, obviously, Exchange 2013, CAS and Mailbox on-prem. This allows us to establish and create the hybrid relationship. The PowerShell interface backend is on the Mailbox server role, not on the CAS server role, as the CAS is now as a stateless proxy. In 2010, we could get by with just the CAS server role, for example. We require Mailbox because we require the PowerShell syntax for doing things such as a new move request, for example, to move mailboxes from on-prem to Office 365, or the reverse. The configuration process is simplified in Exchange 2013. In 2010, there is a series of steps, about a half a dozen or dozen steps, that you would walk through to configure and activate your federated trust and establish a hybrid relationship. With Exchange 2013, there's a wizard which completes all that process for you and only asks you for the information that it needs you to provide. If there's information in Active Directory or Exchange environment that it can gather automatically, it will consume that and leverage that for creating the hybrid relationship. We do require the SMTP domain to be activated in your Office 365 tenant, and as well, the DirSync tool to be enabled, as we're leveraging the DirSync tool to do that directory replication and maintain that directory replication from your on-prem AD environment to your tenant itself. The limitations for hybrid are primarily around Exchange 2003. You cannot introduce an Exchange 2013 environment on-prem to an existing Exchange 2003 org or an org that has Exchange 2003 servers in it. However, if you have an Exchange 2003 org, you can add Exchange 2010 servers to it and establish a federated relationship or a hybrid relationship between that Exchange 2010 SP3 or later server and your Wave 14 or your Wave 15 tenant. So if you have 2003, we have you install Exchange 2010. You won't get the wizard, but you'll get all the other benefits of hybrid around rich coexistence. We can delegate coexistence cross-premises, which means that you can have a user on one side and a manager on the other. In general, we recommend moving them together, but we would support, and you do have the option of having those apart. Migration, same approach. We require the send as or full access permissions between or for the Exchange on-prem environment so that when we're executing the new move requests, we have permissions to those source mailboxes. The hardest part, I think, from the Exchange side for folks to understand when moving to Office 365 is the concept of identity. As I kind of summarized earlier, and we'll just, if you watch the session on identity that was, I think that was this morning, right, Jeff? Is that yesterday afternoon? There is a session that walks you through all the identity options. There's three. Either it's pure Office 365, you have an ID and a password, no relation to on-prem. You have DirSync established, copying the password hash to Office 365. So you've got a user object in Office 365. It has a password, but it's coming from on-prem, so it's being replicated there. So in essence, users have the same password, but they're not. But authentication happens directly in Office 365. Or option three, you have users in Office 365, but all authentication is redirected on-prem. That's the ADFS approach, or there's some third-party tools that cover the same. So depending on your authentication option you choose when you configure hybrid is whether or not you'll have to distribute passwords. If you're using cloud IDs with passwords in Office 365, you'll be creating or provisioning passwords and providing those passwords to users. If you're using DirSync with password sync, you're replicating the hashes. There is no password change required because their Office 365 password will be the same as the password they use on-prem. If you're using simple sign-on with Active Directory Federation services, any authentication to Office 365 will be redirected on-prem, meaning you have to have ADFS up and running and you have to have your Active Directory environment operational, in which case it's their live Active Directory password. The authentication happens on-prem. We pass a token back for access to Office 365. So depending on which of those identity and authorization options you choose, depends on what your password experience will be with the hybrid approach in 2010 or 2013. The Outlook profile is automatically updated via auto-discover again. Outlook 2007 and later clients is the caveat. And the good news here, right, is when you do that mailbox move, there is no OST resync because the GUID has been maintained as it's a native Exchange mailbox move from on-prem to online. If you're running the latest versions of Outlook, patched Outlook for Outlook 2010 or Outlook 2013, users should not have to restart Outlook after the mailbox move. It's a rare exception at this point now, right, with the later versions of it, which means that we can move the mail in the background, user continues to work. There's a moment or two, right, where they won't see new mail as we do the final cutover process on the back end, but at which point Outlook will reconnect to Office 365 and pull the new mail down from there. Yes? Yes, so question is, do you need to configure an auto-discover entry in Exchange Online when we're talking about Exchange Hybrid? Exchange Hybrid is going to talk to the on-prem published endpoints, which is then going to determine is the user online or on-prem and automatically configure the process.
So if you use
So the question is, if using DirSync and the password is copied, you're talking about DirSync. So the question is, if you're using DirSync plus the middle option for authentication, password hash is replicated Office 365, what happens from a Outlook perspective or Outlook authentication perspective when they launch Outlook? The first time they launch Outlook, it's going to ask them for their password. They're going to get a username and password prompt. They'll enter their email, their UPN, and they'll enter their password. They can check a box to save their password. Outlook will no longer prompt until their password changes on-prem and the hash is no longer valid. So if you've got a password change policy of 90 days, 90 days later they'll change it on-prem. The next time they start Outlook, they'll say, oh, we need your new password. You'll enter it, check the box. Outlook will continue to leverage that one and they'll authenticate going forward. I think there was a third question also. We'll catch it later. I was going to say, for the auto-discover question, I thought we had a couple slides on that. It turns out to be the next one. In this case, right, users have on-prem, a user at contoso.com, online, a user at contoso.com. The mailboxes in Office 365 will have a secondary address of the mail.onmicrosoft.com. Any user objects who have been moved will have a mail-enabled user on-prem pointing to the secondary SMTP address of the Office 365 mailbox. So query comes in, as we said, we publish the existing auto-discover records for Exchange 2010 or 2013 are pointing to on-prem. Outlook queries those. Local Exchange says, oh, that's actually I have a mail-enabled user, right, but the actual live user is the one who's in Office 365. We redirect them to that side. Outlook then attempts to discover the autodiscover.contoso.mail.onmicrosoft.com, which we've already published from Office 365, requests authentication, configures the mail profile, Outlook is configured. No OSD rebuild, as we call out. The hybrid improvements in 2013 are primarily focused around the setup and configuration of hybrid. As we stated, in 2010, there was information you had to gather from your org, and there's a series of PowerShell commandlets and activities you do to create or establish this federated trust and the other aspects required around mail flow for a hybrid relationship to be completed. In 2013, we read what we can automatically. We obviously have access to your on-prem AD environment and Exchange. We'll ask you some questions that we do need to ask, and we'll then go ahead and configure both your on-prem environment and your Office 365 tenant to establish hybrid. We've also added support for, if you have Exchange 2010 Edge transport servers, we can automatically push the required configuration information to them directly from the wizard, not requiring you to go out and make perimeter mail flow changes if you had a third-party system, for example, inside of your organization. And from a secure mail perspective, we no longer require IP addresses for this. We can rely on DNS settings instead. EOP, or Exchange Online Protection, is our cloud-hosted hygiene service. And with Exchange 2013 Hybrid, you can do a cutover to EOP from your existing perimeter solution before, during, or after. So we provide you flexibility of when you want to do your perimeter migration as either a pre-project, post-project, or at some time during the middle of the project. There isn't a direct correlation of when you cut over your perimeter mail flow system versus your mailbox migration. So they're disentangled. I'm trying to think of the correct word there. They're not associated with each other, right? You can conduct both migrations or both operations in parallel. As we point out, the centralized mail transporter validating all mail flow goes through your on-prem perimeter systems can even apply when the MX record points to EOP. We do find some customers have some DLP, for example, or other functionality or legal disclaimers that has to occur in a solution that's based on-prem. You can still have that all outbound mail flow through that outbound, that on-prem component, even with EOP as your MX recipient for inbound mail. And finally, a single wizard then, right, whether we're doing hybrid, staged, cutover, et cetera, your mailbox migrations are very straightforward once you configure the hybrid relationship. We will call the appropriate PowerShell commandlets on the back end if you use the wizard, or you're welcome to go directly into PowerShell and use the new migration event commandlet to move mailboxes in batches to Office 365 and provide the parameters there that you're familiar with today. So, looking at the coexistence in a hybrid scenario, we have our directory information replicating via dir sync, and that's a continual event. If we have password hashes, right, in that middle option for authentication, that would be flowing through that process as well. We have secure mail flow established between our on-prem environment and Office 365. All mail is encrypted via TLS. We have the ability for users to do sharing, so free, busy, calendar, and contact sharing, for example, mail tips, archive mailboxes, all this works regardless of their mailbox being on-prem or their mailbox being in Office 365. And mail content itself, we leverage MRS. This means we preserve the GUID. This means you have a very native mailbox move experience. You can move mailboxes back and forth. Current versions of the Outlook client, they're not even going to get the prompt to restart during post that move event completing. So let's take a quick look at what our deployment process looks like with Exchange Hybrid. So in our org, we have Exchange 2010 or 2007. We're going to show you this from an Exchange 2013 perspective, right? So we can't have any 2003 in the org at this point. So we install the appropriate Exchange service packs. I believe right now it's SP3 is the prereq for Exchange 2010. Prepare Active Directory with a 2013 schema. Add our 2013 CAS and mailbox server, which is our functionality required for PowerShell and for the Federated Trust and for the wizard. Install, if we don't have them already, right, the Exchange 2010 Edge servers, configure our external URLs, configure our certificates, and then move our public DNS records to point to the new 2013 CAS environment. So at that point, we have Outlook Web App, AutoDiscover, Exchange Web Services, right, Outlook Anywhere, et cetera, flowing through our Exchange 2013 CAS servers. Those servers will redirect as appropriate to other sites that are running for Exchange 2010 or 2007, but will also provide the appropriate coexistence with Office 365. At that point, we can then switch AutoDiscover, run the hybrid configuration wizard, and we will complete the on-prem and tenant changes required to establish hybrid and create the Federation Trust. So with you, if you have the summary here is, if you have 2010 Edge servers, we'll even manage the mail flow coexistence portion. If you have a third-party perimeter hygiene solution in there, you'll have to make some changes on that once we go to establish the Exchange hybrid configuration, and we'll document that for you. Move mailboxes. So wizard, very straightforward. You launch it, start the wizard, right? Confirm that you want to run Exchange hybrid. Select the hybrid domain. If you have a single domain, this doesn't come up. If you have more than one domain in your tenant, we will provide this to ask which domain you're trying to federate with for Office 365. Once we select, again, optionally, right, if you had a single domain, we won't expose this, but if you have multiple, we'll confirm your domain proof token. Choose your transport options. We're assuming most organizations want to provide TLS for their mail flow between online and on-prem. which 2013 CAS servers in the organization will be the recipient for your mail flow from Office 365, which 2013 on-prem mailbox servers will host the outbound send connector, which would be sending to Office 365, choose the transport certificate, what's the external FQDN for our 2013 CAS, that single Outlook web app URL, right? And then some credentials. We need a credential for our on-prem environment that has org management capabilities, and we need our global admin Office 365 credentials to make the modifications required on the Office 365 tenant. Once complete, you click on update, and all the benefits that we've showed you over the last dozen or so slides will come to fruition for you and your users. Caveats, if you are one of the few remaining Wave 14 tenants, we've been actively upgrading all of our tenants since the introduction of Wave 15 back in the March-April timeframe. You cannot run the Exchange 2013 hybrid configuration wizard until your tenant has been upgraded to Wave 15. If you're in a hurry, you can always use Exchange 2010 to establish hybrid to a Wave 14 tenant, and that relationship will be preserved as you go to Wave 15. If you want to do an Exchange 2013 hybrid relationship, we have to wait for that tenant to go to Wave 15. We do do a check for the tenant and version level in the hardware compatibility wizard. If it comes out that you're not at that version level right, we will show that. You can also always check via PowerShell the current version of your tenant in Office 365 using the git org config commandlet. So at that point, we complete. We know the tenant is Wave 14 or Wave 15. If you have Exchange 2010 SP3 deployed, as we said, that will continue to work as your tenant is moved from Wave 14 to Wave 15, and will continue to support hybrid coexistence even if you have Exchange 2003 in your environment. So if you still have some Exchange 2003, we deploy Exchange 2010, go through the manual steps for hybrid configuration, and now we can move mailboxes from Exchange 2003 to a Wave 15 tenant. Without having to go through a cutover or a staged exchange migration. In general, we recommend Exchange 2013. We think you'll like the hybrid configuration wizard. We have some more checks available there for that, and it's a simpler process. You'll also be supported going forward, right, for a longer time period than if you had a legacy version of Exchange deployed in your hybrid config. Questions on hybrid? I know it's a lot of content for an hour. Online tenant? Yes, the question is, you're using the second option, right? DirSync plus password hash, so bringing over the password hash from on-prem to Office 365. User enters the wrong password too many times in OWA or in their Outlook dialog box on a password change. Can we lock out that user's Office 365 user object? My understanding, and I'll confirm, I'll let Jeff correct me if I get it wrong, is that you have the option of controlling the account lockout policies for your Office 365 user objects, and so it depends on what you choose in that option. Is that, and by default, we do have, I'm trying to remember the default setting, if we have, I'd have to get back to you with the default, I'm trying to remember, I actually did know this a few months ago as I looked it up, and it's getting harder and harder to remember things like that. I think we have it off by default, but I would be telling you, especially since this is recorded, to check on TechNet for that or test it in your tenant. So, but you can make the change. There is a caveat around this I'm trying to think of. If you have password expiration set to a long period, we can't set password expiration to never. We can set it up to several hundred days, and I forget the upper limit on the number on that one. If you do set no password expiration for your user objects, users cannot change their password using the Outlook web app change password option. So that's the one. I do know this now. The default is to have passwords expire for a pure Office 365 cloud tenant, right? And if you have passwords set to expire, users can change your password using Outlook web app. If you change passwords not to expire, they can no longer change your password. You have to have an administrator change the password for the users. And neither of those approaches is leveraged if you're using the DirSync plus password hash. At that point, you're just determining Is there an expiration period or not? If it expires before the, and you'd want it to line up with your on-prem password policy, right? If your online policy was 30 days and your on-prem was 90, your online password would change and they would have to change your password, it would be out of sync. Any other questions? Yep, one more. The DirSync plus hybrid option? It's possible that you could make directory changes in the Office 365 tenant. By default, DirSync is a one-way push from on-prem to online. The option to write back is would enable you to have modifications that are made in Office 365 be written back to... Pardon? Yes. Question on... Yeah, I know there's a list of them, and I was trying to think. There's a couple use case scenarios. So the question is, there is an option in DirSync, right, to allow changes in Office 365 to flow backwards. And the question is more specificity around what actually would be written back. There is a link on TechNet that does show, as Jeff called out, the list of attributes. And it's escaping my memory right now on the changes that can happen that might require one of those attributes to get pushed back. In general, though, it's off by default. We assume most orgs are managing all identity on-prem and flowing that to Office 365. I think that is the end. We called out, right? Make sure you attend. You get a chance to get a one-year subscription for Office 365 or one of the wonderful AttackNid Doom Razors. Those are the crabs that we've been giving out. Please fill out your evals. We do read those. We have been... trying to tune our event content and feedback based on that over the past few years at all the events. And we read it more than you might anticipate. So thanks for coming out. Appreciate your time.